Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Well, welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. What is newsworthy right now is the subject of suffering. Suffering is something that everyone deals with. It doesn't matter where you are in life, there's always some sort of suffering or adversity that you deal with. And the thing about the mind is that the mind doesn't work on levels of suffering. Whatever suffering you're going through is real to you. So the seventh grade girl who got broken up with, who got dumped because her boyfriend was all of a sudden getting friendly with an eighth grade girl, she thinks her life is over. She thinks that's the worst thing that happens to her. And to her, that is just as real as the suffering she will experience when she becomes an adult. Now, if you're an adult and you still think your suffering of getting dumped in the seventh grade is the biggest deal, we might want to get some help. But the thing about suffering is no matter where you are in life, it's something that's going to happen to you and it's something you have to deal with. But one of the things I hope to discuss is the idea that suffering has multiple layers to it. There's a parable, a story about this bird flying through the Arctic. And the bird was freezing, so cold, but someone dumped trash on the bird. And so the trash warmed up the bird, and so the bird was happy, so it started to chirp around a little bit. And the cat heard the bird chirping, reached into the pile of trash, pulled out the bird, and then ate him. And the moral of the story is not everyone who dumps trash on you is your enemy, and not everyone who pulls you out of the trash is your friend. Suffering is one of those things that does the same thing. You don't know if it's always bad for you because somehow in faith you see suffering as something that helps you grow. And so I want to talk about this tonight, and there was only one person that I thought would be the expert on this, and so that is my good friend from Memphis, Tennessee, Joshua Ross. Welcome.
Hey, man.
Welcome all the way from Memphis, Tennessee to Newsworthy with Norisworthy.
Hey, I appreciate it. Hey, dude, before we go any further, where did you get the name? Where'd it come from?
The name Newsworthy with Norisworthy. I think you would actually be someone who'd appreciate this because you were a star quarterback in high school at Mesquite Poteet, and this name comes from a football coach as well, someone that you'd be very familiar with, not my football coach, but a football coach in general. You see, boss, when I was in high school, my football coach used to come to me and say, "Son, Norisworthy, one day you'll be newsworthy. If you just keep working the legs, son, keep working the legs in the gym." So that was the name. And I had never really became newsworthy on the football field like you did. But maybe that was a prophecy about this very podcast years later.
All right, man. That's good enough for me.
Yeah,
let's roll with it.
Yeah, that's good, man. Well, I'm glad to have you in via the magic of Skype, bringing you in here from Memphis, Tennessee, which you wrote a book entitled Scarred Faith, in which you said Memphis was the second most miserable city in the United States, which is kind of a weird thing to say since you live in that city.
Let's clarify that comment right now, okay? I did not say that my experience was it was the second most miserable city in the United States. Forbes magazine a few years ago listed Memphis as the second most miserable city in the United States.
That makes a lot more sense because I know Justin Timberlake would never say that about Memphis, and I didn't think you would either. So that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, dude, and neither would Elvis or some of the other famous people from it. Morgan Freeman, you know.
Yes. Who else is famous from Memphis, Josh?
Man, I don't have time to list all of them tonight.
Penny Hardaway, that's the most famous guy from Memphis. We all know that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we want to talk about suffering tonight. And you wrote a book entitled Scarred Faith, in which it talks about your struggle and your journey dealing with grief and a few other things. And the real grief that seems to be the epicenter of the book is the story about your sister. A few years ago, you had made the move from suburbs of Memphis. You're moving into inner city Memphis. And in the midst of that transition in your life, tragedy struck with your sister. You want to briefly tell the story of what happened with Jenny?
Yeah, man. Yeah, because there were two events that collided in my life at about the same time. This was probably late in 2009. Casey and I mean, at the time, I think Truett, our oldest son, was three. Our youngest son, I don't even know if he was one yet. And man, we were just wrestling with where we needed to live, and we loved where we were living. We loved the neighborhood. But it was probably the second week of January. Together with some of our friends, we decided to put our homes on the market and to move into a – at the time, we didn't know where we were going to live. We just knew that there was a calling in our lives to move into a blighted, depressed neighborhood to see what God was up to. and man, you know, back in 2010 is not when you need to put a house on the market. I mean, it's not when you need to try to make a move like that. But we also felt like this was just an act of obedience. So we couldn't wait 5 or 6 years for the housing market to get better. So we made a decision then that we were going to move. And it was about 2 weeks later, we got the call that Jenny had been very sick. She had been running a fever for a few days, which and a very high fever, which isn't too unfamiliar. I mean, this happens with my family. I mean, we usually, when we run fever, we run high fevers. But she had been running about 104, 105 for about 5 days, been pretty sick. So I got the call on a Thursday morning that she was going into ICU. What happened was she was suffering from strep throat. It entered into her bloodstream, so she quickly became – her body was suffering from septic shock. And, man, you were there with us in and out of that 18-day experience there in Fort Worth. She lost her life on February 22nd. Here I was, a 29-year-old pastor, preaching my 31-year-old sister's memorial service on February 25th. My brother, a worship pastor, did an amazing job that day, leading us before the throne of God. But, you know, there in a 6-week period of time, our family made a decision to move, to enter into, I mean, one way just to put it is to enter into the sufferings of the world to see what God was up to. Mm-hmm. And then we were also dealt this blow in our own family with this, with the death of my sister, you know. And so together we kind of just had to wrestle, our family had to wrestle with, all right, what's this going to look like? What's, you know, is our hope rooted in the resurrection that's going to keep us going, or...
Yeah.
So from there kind of came a journal that I started because I needed to wrestle with some faith questions in my own heart, which ended up becoming the book.
Well, one of those faith questions you include in the book was from which basically seemed like a prayer to me, was a prayer in which you had the line that you didn't want to give into the temptation to have low expectations of God, which is a really right. interesting thing to say because just to be blunt, there are some people that have too high of expectations of God. Now, they're not mm-hmm. realistic expectations of God. They're expectations that God would never let their 31-year-old sister get sick and pass away. They would – their expectations, God would never, you know, let people, you know, in Memphis who deal with some real tough times and go through not having jobs and among other things, that God would never let that happen to them. They have too high of expectations where those are just not realistic. That's not what God has promised.
Right.
And so maybe some people need a lower expectation of God, but you said you don't want a low expectation of God. So what's wrong with having a low expectation of God?
Well, you know, I think there and again, man, I was journaling what ended up becoming that chapter where I talked about that. So it wasn't that I had publication in mind. I was working through that because I knew that. That months after Jenny died, I was still stepping up week in and week out, and I was preaching sermons. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I could continue to step up in front of people and tell a gospel story week in and week out for years to come. But the question that – maybe it didn't haunt me, but the question that was heavy upon my heart is, all right, what kind of disciple am I going to be going forward? Mm-hmm. And how I answer and wrestle with that question is going to depend. I mean, that's going to have an impact on what kind of father am I? What kind of husband am I going to be? What kind of minister and pastor am I going to be moving forward? And I do think there are a lot of people who, and man, let's be frank, all right? There are a lot of pastors who choose to preach and teach and even maybe live a gospel that has very low expectations and low anticipation of what God can do. Because if we have low expectations and low anticipation, we won't ever have to feel like God has let us down. Mm-hmm. You know, when 31-year-old sisters die or when tragedy strikes or things just happen that just do not make sense. And, you know, I think it's a form of deism, just the whole idea that God kind of started up the world and set it in motion and then kind of took his hands off and one day he's going to make things right. But even when people talk to me, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I was somewhere talking about scarred faith and someone came up to me afterwards and they were very affirming of the book. But one thing they said is, Jenny is where Jenny wants to be. She is now with God. And if she had the choice to come back to be with her daughter, she would say no. All right, so here's the idea, okay? That what comes from some people is she has now gone to be with God. But what does that say? What does that say about God now?
Yeah.
And if the church is the bride of Christ, all right, so we've entered into this covenant. What does that say about Jesus as a groom or as a husband?
Yeah.
If the thought is we have to go to be with God, but if God is here, if Jesus is present among us, if the promise Jesus made it at the very end of the Gospel of Matthew, right after the Great Commission, is I am with you always. All right, then this is going to change. This is going to have an impact on how I live day in and day out. That God isn't just up in the sky. He's not like some lifeguard who occasionally jumps in to, mm-hmm. Save someone. But God is right here in the mess of life.
Yeah.
I made the decision then, okay. And even today, a few years later, that I want to live believing that God is still in the here and now.
Yeah, that's good. Now, one of the things you touched on there was the dirty little secret of all preachers is that as we're calling people to a life of faith, we are wrestling with faith ourselves. Because faith mm-hmm. is never something you just, well, I learned this in seminary. I've got faith for the rest of my life, but you've got to wrestle with it. And you get up and you have to preach weeks after this happened. Your dad's a preacher as well. He had to get up and say that the resurrection is real after he saw his own daughter pass away. So So talk about that as a pastor, as a preacher. How are you wrestling with your faith while still calling the rest of us to live out faith?
Yeah. Yeah, this is where I think Randy Harris, he's, a mentor to both of us, has had a huge impact on our lives.
And we all heard him on the last episode of Newsworthy with Newsworthy.
That's right, man. But Randy said something our freshman year of college. You and I were in the same Bible class. And I remember Randy saying, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is complacency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that has never left me. And in those seasons of when I've had some doubt, that's just something that has given me hope that I think when doubts are still causing us and leading us to asking really good questions, it can be a healthy thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that Jesus, right before the Great Commission, it says they worshiped him and some doubted. And Jesus still gave the Great Commission to that entire crowd. Like, he didn't separate the doubters from the worshipers. The worshipers were made up of doubters. And what I think what we will continue to wrestle with some for the rest of my life, and what led me to even journaling, which became the book, was this: the faith crisis I found myself in wasn't does God exist or does God not exist. I know some people have been through those seasons.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it wasn't does God exist or does God not exist. For me, it was when does God choose to intervene and when does God choose to keep his hands off?
Mm-hmm.
When does God choose to stick his finger into something and when does God keep his hands off or choose not to be involved?
Yeah.
I don't think I came out of that season with clear answers of a God's activity in the world, just with this confidence that God is active.
So a realistic faith that you're describing is not one that says God's always going to intervene, but God can and will, and faith is just trusting that God will do what he's going to do, and we trust that he's for us and he's there, but you don't always understand exactly why he intervenes and doesn't. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yeah. That, and I think also, I mean, what I advocate for and even how I talk about God week in and week out is that even through the suffering, even in the tragedies, even through the storms, all right, God can be present through mm-hmm. that. And, one thing I even write about in the book is, sometimes what I've needed, not just with my sister's death, but how I've engaged Memphis and other forms of brokenness I've experienced in my life, sometimes what I've needed isn't a God who will just reach down and like pull me out of a pit or out of a valley, but a God who's willing to get down in a valley and a pit with me. And dude, that does something for my faith.
Yeah.
That there's a God who will walk through the mess of life with me.
Yeah, that's good news. So suffering, the good news is that God is with you in that you're connected to God even in suffering. One of the other things you say in your book is that in a strange way, suffering links us with creation.
Mm-hmm.
How does suffering connect us to creation? And what do you mean by that?
I kind of latch on to a couple of times when Paul talks about how all creation groans for redemption. Genesis 1 and 2, man, things were going really well. And I think what happens in Genesis 3 isn't just the fall of humanity. It's when all creation went berserk. I think Genesis 3 is when, calamities and tragedies and natural disasters and stuff like that entered into the world. So the Bible is the story of God who comes and wants to redeem, all things. So as we suffer, creation suffers, and all of it wants to be made right by God. So, we're just wrapped up in this story of suffering, yet this God who's active and actively working to redeem creation. I think that's a beautiful thing, man.
Yeah, that's really
And I thought it was cool. I mean, you and I were part of a group just recently who, some ministers who took the Lord's Supper together. Mm-hmm. And, when we finished that, the guy who was leading us in that ceremony in that time said, "All right, there's some bread that we've prayed over, and we can't just go throw it in a trash can." Mm-hmm. So dude, here we are as, 12 young ministers, and we're walking around in the woods, tossing the bread, out of this, almost this covenant that, all creation is groaning for what we've experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful picture. I might have eaten half of that bread because I was really hungry, but creation got half of the bread that I was supposed to give. Yeah, that's a cool picture. One of the things you also talk about is how scars shape us, that scars shape your faith. And, mm-hmm. and that makes a lot of sense. I heard that the Sam Adams Brewery, which is based in Boston, has other factories, I think like ones in Ohio and Pennsylvania. But since the beer was started in Boston, it requires that exact same beer for it to come out with the same – or the same water that's in Boston to have the same flavor. And the problem is Boston water is terrible. And so they have to ship out like chemicals to make the water in Ohio and Pennsylvania as bad as it is in Boston just to have as good a beer there, which is a kind of interesting picture that you need bad water to make good beer. If you think Sam Adams is good beer, obviously a lot of people do.
So
there's almost like the same idea that you have to have bad experiences. You have to go through bad times for you to have good faith. So how do you think scars shape your faith?
Yeah, and man, this has been something that's connected with a lot of people because as I was journaling, I think before I even had publication in mind, there's one day I was writing and I think what I laid before God that day was, God, I just feel like I'm a scarred person. And I felt as if God's response was, yeah, you know what, you are scarred, but welcome to a scar-filled world. It's a world full of scars.
Yeah.
And I think how it shapes our faith is this, the good news about a scar is that a scar is a healed wound.
Good.
And all of us have wounds and scars, and it can be physical, emotional, psychological, social. I mean, we could go on with some of the wounds and scars that we bear. Now, if we keep picking at the wounds in our lives, it never becomes a healed wound. It never becomes a scar. It remains a wound. And so we're lacking some healing in our lives. But the good news about a scar is it's a healed wound. Mm-hmm. Now, another truth about scars, whether they're physical, mental, emotional, psychological, whatever, is that every single scar we bear has a story. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I could have some fun here for the next few minutes if we just took time explaining some of the scars that we have because of stupid things we did as kids or as adults. And, every scar we bear, I mean, there's a story that goes with it. So I think how it develops faith is, for one, do we trust that God can take the wounds of our lives and can redeem them and heal them, all right, so that they become scars. And once the scars are there, all right, do we trust that God can redeem those stories?
Yeah.
And how are we doing as a church when it comes to allowing people to be able to share, the scars of our lives and the stories? Because that's how the story of redemption begins to spread.
Yeah, that's good, man. You know, there's that line that it seems like the writer of Hebrews is using this line to shape the way he or she is writing the book of Hebrews. It's this phrase from the first century, pathin mathin, which means to suffer is to learn. And you could say it backwards, that to learn is to suffer. And so we get the idea, okay, learning, like that, yeah. Learning is suffering, suffering is learning. And James and Romans, they say the same stuff. They talk about how you consider trials of many kinds to be pure joy because it produces perseverance, and you know, perseverance runs a course and makes you mature and complete, not lacking anything. And so there's this high respect for adversity as something that's really important for our development. Like, you have to have it. You have to have scars. I heard a doctor talk about how kids at a young age, they need to get their colds because it lets their bodies develop antibodies so that they can fight off bigger illnesses when they get older. So we all get that. And suffering's supposed to develop faith. You know, the Bible clearly talks about that. But how come there's so many people that have been through so many adverse situations, but they don't have faith? But others who go through similar experiences turn out on the other side with this deep, robust faith. So why do you think some people go through, embrace suffering and embrace the goodness that comes out of it, but others don't seem to get the benefits from it?
Oh, man. Wow. Dude, that's a – you write a book on that, man. You wouldn't have to be a pastor anymore.
Yeah, well, we got to figure it out. I mean, how does that happen?
Yeah. Man, let me take a shot at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, one, there's something about suffering in community that I think can be a beautiful thing. And, you know, do we have healthy communities around us that can allow us to ask some of the hard questions? Because, you know, let's just face it, in some circles, even in some faith communities, the idea of doubt or wrestling, you know, some people just want to say, hey, this was God's will, just accept it as it is, don't ask questions, move forward. And I think sometimes that can do more damage to someone's faith. I think the thought of being able to sit in the grace of God as he allows us to bring every emotion to the table, everything we're feeling, and to lay it bare. And sometimes maybe we don't need all of the answers. We just need to be able to walk through that process knowing there's a God who will sit with us through it.
Yeah, that's good.
That can help develop faith. So, you know, are we allowing people, you know, to even ask the questions to wrestle with God? Man, there are some people who've experienced so much suffering, they just don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah, I think it's a good point about being connected in community. One of the things that was most striking about the whole situation with your sister passing away is something that happened 2 weeks after. I got a dog when I got engaged. Chief was his name. And when my wife and I got engaged, she got a ring. I got a dog. You know, it doesn't really add up financially, but I think it turned out well for me. But he had cancer, and so we put him down maybe 2 weeks after Jenny passed away. And so I wasn't going to call you up and say, oh, hey, Josh, guess what? I put my dog down. Give me sympathy. And so I never told you about it. But somehow you found out, and you called me. I said, man, I heard your dog passed away. I heard you had to put Chief down, and I'm just really sorry about it. And I was really overwhelmed by that because obviously he meant a whole lot to me. And anyone's ever had to put down their first dog, they get it. But you don't expect someone who's just performed the funeral service for their 31-year-old sister to have sympathy for that. But I think that's a beautiful picture of that community you're talking about, where even there's not like levels of, okay, you're on a 10, so I'm on a 2, so you can't talk to me. But somehow we're all suffering in big ways and small ways together, right?
Right, yeah.
So how do communities learn to suffer together?
Yeah, I mean, and even what I pushed for in the last few chapters of the book is, you know, there's got to be we need places of honesty. Mm-hmm. You know, where we can be ourselves, ask the questions. And there really is something, and I know sometimes it's a buzzword that maybe it's been overused, but just authenticity, you know, to truly come as you are. I think that's where it begins, you know, being able to cultivate communities where we can wrestle with the hard questions. Mm-hmm. And truly, you know, truly do life together. I mean, this seems to be what the early church discovered early on, and how those Christ followers lived. You know, that suffering was inevitable. And man, you were hitting on it a minute ago. Do some of the things, some of the claims these New Testament writers make that just sound ridiculous, you know, how there's joy in the midst of suffering and count it as pure joy when you suffer. But man, there was something in them that, hey, it's through suffering that we're connected to the Jesus way. We're connected in the cycle of death, burial, and resurrection. And to be in a community that knows that the way our story goes is that all the suffering we bear, it's going to be redeemed. The resurrection is real.
Yeah.
So we keep pointing to that empty tomb.
Yeah, you keep pointing. That's good, man. One of the things that you see with suffering on a more universal level is that suffering does seem to point people to something transcendent. And you talked about that in your book, that the success of Mercy Me song, I can only imagine, cannot be removed from its context. It came out right around the time of 9/11, which was a time that shook Americans to the core because it took away the sense of security. You know, that, hey, we're always going to be safe, and so when you're not safe, you're overwhelmed. And and you can't understand the success of that without that song, without understanding the cultural climate that it was birthed into. You know,
so
why do you think suffering points us to the divine?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think you point to that song because maybe I write too much upon the American people who just people in the world who made that song popular. But you know, the song was written in 1999, but it wasn't released until 2001. And even though it's a song about connecting with Jesus in heaven, I think there were so many people who were latching onto the song because they wanted to imagine a different world. You know, they wanted the hope of a different world. And you're right, man. I think suffering for all people, whether they're Christ followers or wherever they are in life, suffering leads us to a point where we want something. We want something different. We want something greater. We want to imagine that there is a better way. And, you know, it does cause all kind of questions to come up in us that, you know, hopefully God can do something with.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right on that. Well, let's close with this last question. In your book, you have a chapter talking about being a disciple when you don't get your way, which I think is a that's got to be a lifelong lesson for all of us. I mean, what do you do when you don't get your way? How do you still have faith in God? How do you still choose to follow the way of Jesus when things don't go your way? That's and I figure when you get the answer for that, you can sell a million books on that question alone. So, give us one way you can. Don't get your way. What can help you continue to follow the way of Jesus when you don't get the job you want, when you don't get the promotion you want, when your kids aren't always healthy, when life doesn't give you the breaks you want?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's as simple as this. All right. What are the big rocks for you in your walk with God? Like, what are those? What are the claims that you're standing on? Because I think the older we get, I think the more we suffer, those claims become fewer and fewer, you know, where, you know, debates about worship style just don't hold up much anymore. But what does matter is, you know, for me, it was as simple as this. What I need to remind myself of is, all right, God is love. All right. The resurrection is true. And if those two things exist, all right, that God is driven more by love than just getting glory. And the resurrection is true, then we know that not only does death not win, suffering doesn't win.
Yeah. Man, that's really good. Well, boss,
Jesus wins.
That's good stuff right there, man. Well, thank you, man, for your time. We appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again later. Thanks, boss.
Hey, man. Proud of you, dude. Thanks.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.